Welcome, everyone. I'm Roy Hammerling. I'm a chair of the religion department at Concordia College in Moorhead, Minnesota. And I'm really glad to be here at Holden. I always enjoy being here for a week in the summer. We've been coming for a number of years and grew up not too far away from here, so this feels like coming back home, even though I live in Fargo, North Dakota, and teach in across the river in Moorhead. The three sessions I decided to talk about, for those of you who were here on the Hildegard session, which was last night, when I was asked to think about the theme, Fear Not, last year when I came here, I talked about Luther and the 500th anniversary of the 95 Theses, and a little bit about his journey and why that whole story is important. And so this year I thought I wanted to talk about women. I teach a course on women in religious history and take students to Europe, and we visit various sites where a number of women who have changed the face of the world live. And so these are some women that I've studied and have some scholarly interests in. And so tonight we're going to look at Joan of Arc. Notice last time we started really in the 12th century, and we're jumping to the 15th century, and then we'll jump to the 20th century to try to put these three women next to each other and see what we can learn, if there's anything interesting to be had. And I find these three women spectacularly interesting. Hildegard of Bingen, probably the great Renaissance woman of the Middle Ages. She was known by many as the first woman doctor in Germany. She had all these medical texts that she wrote. She was a visionary, had visions, and started developing a theological ideas like greenness, God is greenness and life, veriditas. And so she was a famous theologian. She was an advisor to kings, who kings often didn't want her advice because she told them to be just and good. She got in arguments with popes, also was one of the most prolific songwriters of the Middle Ages, wrote a number of hymns, wrote the first morality play, wrote the first musical ever written. She was an abbess, she was a preacher, which is unheard of for women in the Middle Ages, a really true Renaissance woman, extremely, probably one of the most well-educated women, and all of the pictures show her writing, and often looking up and having visions. Tonight, we're going to contrast her with the exact opposite of that. We're going to talk about Joan of Arc. Hildegard lives a long life and has a long, productive life. Joan has a very short life. Joan is illiterate. She can't read, write. Well, she can write one thing, her name. And we actually have probably about four or five pieces of her signing her name. And by looking at the paleography, we could tell she doesn't know how to do it very well. That she must struggle with it. So it's a problem. So one of the things I wanted to point out is that as I put these four women beside each other, these three women beside each other, I noticed four things about the idea or the concept of fear not, as I nearly kill myself walking around the podium, which is from Isaiah 41 and 43. The idea of how do you not fear? That was the question I kind of wondered. And so the first question that came to my mind was, what fears do these women have? And I noticed that in all three cases, they all have personal doubts and about their own shortcomings, about who they are as individuals. And often that's just simply that you're a woman in a medieval culture that doesn't allow women to be educated. It doesn't allow women to have positions of power or a voice in those societies. And that's true for Joan of Arc and Hildegard of Bingen, for example. But we'll talk a little bit more about other sorts of shortcomings and fears that they had and Joan had. The other thing is that I found that all three of these women lived at a time of great world turmoil. Hildegard lived at a time during the Crusades and battles between Muslims and Christians and all sorts of those things, and we'll find out more about Joan. They all had great uncertainty about their religious institutions and the values of their institutions and challenged those institutions. And thirdly, they all had great doubts and about their ability to persist despite their hopelessness in their situations, what they were trying to work out. So how did they deal with that fear, and what were those fears? So I'd like to talk about Joan. This is one of the earliest portraits of her that we have. Notice that there's a banner and a sword, and her armor is going to be really important. I want you to keep a very close eye on her armor and the way it's styled. And we'll talk more about that when we get a little farther down the road. So a few details about Joan of Arc, just some things to know about. Joan was born, we don't know. We don't even know the year. In her trial, when Joan is put on trial, and we know more about Joan of Arc than any other woman or person of the Middle Ages because of the extensive trial that goes on later, where they interviewed every person that knew her that was alive. And they ask very, very many intimate details about her. You know, when she, you know, did she feel this way or that way about all these sorts of things? We have this magnificent, feel free to just come on in. We have this magnificent record of her life. It's very astonishing. So we know a lot about her, but the dilemma is a lot of what we know about her is written by her enemies. Even though they're interviewing people, it's written, it's somewhat altered by her enemies. But during the trial, when we're getting some of this information, they ask her, how old are you? And she goes, I don't know, 19? Thereabouts? I don't know. It wasn't important to them. That sort of thing. Never kept birthdays, never did any of that. So we don't know when she was born. The date that's traditional is January 6th. I think that date got placed on her because one of the things that's interesting about January 6th, as we all know, it's the 12th day of Christmas, it's the coming of the wise men, and this idea of vision, a vision of a star. And Joan has visions, and I think they just said, we don't know what her birthday is, we're just giving her January 6th. Make it very symbolic. If she's right that she's 19, she probably was born in the year 1412. She was born in a lovely little town called Doremi, and you can almost sing it, all right? In France, I'll show you in a minute where that's at. Her parents were Jacques d'Arc and Isabelle, who was from Doremi, and their occupations were peasants. I'm not sure you call them, is that an occupation? It's a curse that was placed upon a lot of people in the Middle Ages. Today, the town is called Doremi-la-Pucelle. That means Doremi, the town of Doremi of the Maid. And it's, as you can see, it's on the east side of France, the northern east side of France. And actually, if you go just a few hours to the west, you will run right into where Hildegard of Bingen was. So they're actually not too far away. If you're wondering and want to read you want to read the trials and the retrial of Joan of Arc, Regine Pruneau's book does a really nice job of giving a long sort of biographical introduction to each chapter. It goes through her life biographically, and it gives you Joan's words, where she talks about what she was like as a child, what sorts of things happened to her throughout her life, and it's very well done, and I use this with my students and when we have a chance to read about her. Yeah, sure. We'll see in a minute, but actually that's a perfect lead into my next question, because it was on the trials, at the trials that Joan gets put on trial for later. We'll see why that she gets put on trial. But when she's put on trial, there's recorders. There's like three or four recorders writing down everything, and later on they would go and sit down and make sure they had their notes the same and that. But it's interesting, I want to start with a bit of a mystery about Joan of Arc. And one of the things that's interesting about her is because she was so nationalistic oriented, so focused on France, that English-speaking audiences didn't really know much about her until the late 19th century. And Harper's Magazine, in the late 19th century, started a serial, they used to do these in magazines. David Copperfield and all these books were sent out in serials, right? They started a serial publication that was called The Personal Reflections of Joan of Arc by Sieur Louis de Conde. And it was published in 1896. The Easton, like I said, people in England and the United States didn't know much about Joan. It said it was translated by Jean-Francois Aldon. The opening line is this. It says, "This is the year 1492, and I am 82 years of age. The things I'm going to tell you are things which I myself saw as a child and as a youth. All the tales and songs and histories of Joan of Arc, which you and the rest of the world read and sing and study in books, wrought in the late invented art of printing, mentioned," said printing developed in 1450, so that's the printing press, Gutenberg, so he's noticing that the printing starting, "mentioned is made of me, of Louis de Conte. I was her page and her secretary. I was with her from the beginning until the end. I was reared in the same village as she was." And what this Harper's Magazine points out is that they had recently found this record of this close friend of hers who lived in Doremi, followed her into the on the way. He later becomes a cleric, and then he's one of the people, the scribes, writing down everything. And this became wildly popular. The life of Joan of Arc was really interesting to people. Until somebody noticed that there was something odd about the text. And they thought, we've been bamboozled. This is not a historical document, although many of the elements of the document are very, very historical. Many of the words of Joan are taken directly out of her trials and retrials and all these sorts of things. It was actually written by this man, Mark Twain. He made up the entire, made up the story. What happened to Mark Twain is he had amassed a large fortune writing. And he decided to invest that fortune in a new invention, kind of like a typewriter. He put all of his money into this thing and the thing failed. He lost almost all of his money. And towards the end of his life, he had to figure out how to make a living. And so what he decided to do was that with what little money he had, he went on a circuit where he lectured. He hated the lecture, but you know, he just went around and did it so he could make money. And he went to Europe and he was lecturing in Europe. And he has some very funny lectures, like his lecture on the German language. If you know German, you should read it. It's one of the funniest things you'll ever read. He is one of the great humorists. But while he was living in France, he one day read something about Joan of Arc, and I said not many people knew about her, and he started reading about her, and he became infatuated with her. In fact, he became so infatuated with her, he started studying her. And so later, when it came out that Twain had actually written this book, he wrote this about it. He says, "I like Joan of Arc best of all of my books, and it is the best. I know it perfectly well, and besides, it furnished me 7 times the pleasure it afforded me by any of the others." 12 years of preparation. For 12 years, he read texts and went through the study and made sure. First of all, Mark Twain is incredibly cynical, right? You know, his writing, if you've read anything that he writes, he doesn't, you know, he's very hard on human nature. He's very hard on people. He's very hard, especially on political structures. And, you know, his Connecticut Yankee and King Arthur's court is an excuse to kind of attack Britain, and if you see that. And here he says, he starts reading, and he's just taken by Joan of Arc. He doesn't know what to do with her because she kind of undermines his worldview. And he says, 12 years of preparation, 2 years of writing, the others needed no preparation and got none. And so that became his work. And so it's a very interesting read. It's a very good read. And I think if you ever wanted to read the book, you can find it. And it's in various versions out there. So Twain's novel breaks her life down into 3 parts. And those 3 parts fit with my 4 parts ideas that I want to talk about. Her childhood, from her age birth to 16. And I want to talk about her personal doubts and shortcomings in that part. The second part, in the court and in the camp, seeking peace in a war-torn world. And then thirdly, her trial and death, seeking a compassionate God in the church and also persisting in spite of hopelessness. So Joan of Arc's childhood, she's a really interesting normal, couldn't be more normal girl in anywhere in medieval Europe, maybe around the world at the time. Maybe that's part of her appeal, that she is kind of just a universal woman. She is a shepherd girl, a very limited life experience. She can't read, she can't write. She's devoutly religious. She likes to go to church regularly. She's caught in a world of traditional roles and a very unsupportive family. Her father was a very harsh man. We'll see that in a minute. Her mother was always making her work hard. And there was nothing in her childhood that would make you think that this woman is anything special, except for the fact that when she was Meredith's age, and that's Meredith right there, wave your hand. When she was Meredith's age, she started having visions. And she was about 12, 13, somewhere in there. And so at about the age of 13, this call comes to her. And she tells us in the trials that she was simply standing in her father's garden. And all of a sudden she hears a voice. And you can kind of see in this diagram this sort of angel-like figure on the left side, right? And this is Jules Bastien Lepage, beautiful painting of Joan. And one of the things, she's inspired art in so many different ways, but especially in the visual arts. At 13, she hears voices. What does that mean? I want to jump back for a minute. Last time I skipped a question, for those of you here with Hildegard of Bingen, who had these visions as well, about what are visions and what was going on with Julian of Norwich, who was having visions, Hildegard of Bingen, and Joan of Arc. And all of these people who had visions refer back to a writing by a man by the name of St. Augustine. St. Augustine is very important for Lutherans, for example. Augustine wrote a rule that a monastic order developed later on. It's called the Augustinian Order, and or the Order of Augustinian Hermits. And Martin Luther was an Augustinian hermit and read Luther, Augustine, regularly, and was very profoundly influenced by him. Augustine, in his literal commentary on Genesis, book 12, chapter 20, if you're interested, writes, he says that there are really three types of visions that people have. He defines them. And the first one, he says, is that their visions are basically bodily. Sometimes visions are bodily. And what he means by that is, you know the story of the transfiguration of Jesus? Jesus is with the 12 disciples. He takes three of them, Peter, James, and John, off to the side. They go up a mountain. And at the top of the mountain, there's this transfiguration experience. Jesus becomes bright white, and all of a sudden, they see Moses and Elijah there. And Peter, now what's distinguishing about this vision at this point is that we know, of the way the vision is described, we know that it happens in a particular time. And it was a time of day. It happens in a particular place on this particular mountain. If you go to Israel today, there's a traditional place where this took place. It happens in time and place, and you can see it with your bodily eyes. Peter sees Moses and Elijah, and he says, "Oh, this is wonderful. Let's build three tents and just stay here forever." And Jesus goes, "No, that's not what we're going to do." But notice kind of the very physicality of it, and it's very rooted in time and space. That's the first type of vision. The second type, says Augustine, is a spiritual vision. And this happens outside of time and place. And I want you to think into the book of Isaiah, chapter 6, for a minute. Isaiah is a prophet, and he says in Isaiah 6, "I was taken up into the heavens." And all of a sudden now we're not in time and space, right? We're not in Holden, we're not in Israel where Isaiah was. He's in the heavens. Yeah?
No, he describes it as in the sixth year of the king of Uzziah.
He says it in a particular...
I was in the temple.
I was in the temple.
In place.
In the temple, but that he's in God's presence.
Yeah.
And not in the temple.
But
and in fact, he says when the vision happened. But when he says, "Am I in my body or out of my body?" He's in God's presence, and he sees the heavens, and he sees the cherubim and the seraphim, mm-hmm. and God says, "Who will send my, take me, take the message," right? And an angel grabs a coal and stuffs it into his mouth. Mm-hmm. Does that, that's physical, is it? it's out of body and space, but it's kind of like God is cauterizing his mouth at that moment. And then he says, oh, I'll go. I'll go make the message. So it's really not, even though he says where it happens, where he has the vision in the temple, he's really not in the temple when the vision happens. He's in the court of heaven. And he hears this phrase, holy, 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 the angels are singing, which we use in our liturgies, right? That comes straight from Isaiah. So it's outside of time and place. Paul, in his letters, even says, I had a vision where I was carried up into the third heaven, and whether I was in my body or out of my body, I don't know, right? So again, there's this sort of idea that Augustine suggests that there are these visions. It's interesting, Hildegard's visions is somewhere between those, right? She says, I could see with my outer eyes, but then I had an inner light. And so it's kind of these visions are out of time and space. And the other thing that's unique is that they usually happen to you alone, right? Whereas in the other vision, Jesus, Peter, James, and John are all there and they're all seeing the same thing. And then Augustine says the third type is called an intellectual vision. And this one's beyond description. So this becomes a problem because you can't describe it once it happens. And the best example I have is from Augustine. So in a way, Paul's vision, he says, whether I was in my body or out of my body, I don't know, but I was in the celestial heavens. And he can't really describe what has happened to him. So Augustine uses that as an illustration. But Augustine also at one time says he was sitting at the deathbed of his mother. And his mother is talking to him. And she's saying he's just converted to Christianity. She's very happy about his conversion. But she knows that she's going to die. And so she says to him, you know, just leave my body here. They're in Rome, in a town called Ostia, that's the port city for Rome. He says, just leave my body here. Just bury me. You don't need to take me back to Africa. You're going back to Africa. It doesn't matter what happens to my body. I have hope in God. And Augustine then says something like this. We talked about life and death, and together we were taken beyond the trees and the stars and the cosmos into the very presence of God. And we sought and we found and we touched truth, wisdom. And then I came back to this place where sentences have beginnings and end, and every word we make is nothing but noise. Now, what happened to he and his mother? They had some sort of experience in which they felt great comfort, the presence of the divine, and they felt as if everything was right in the world, even though she was going to die. And then Augustine goes on to say how he wept, but his tears were mingled with joy and sadness. So what types of visions are we going to be talking about with Joan? Well, the Rémy church, where Dom Rémy comes from, Joan's home church, is a small little church. There's nothing really or extraordinary about it. It's kept up because it was her church, but it's pretty basic. It's pretty simple. But when she hears these voices, I notice that these visions, these painters are trying to figure out what to do. How do the voices come to her? She describes them as voices, but does she see people? In the trials later on, she doesn't really want to talk about the voices much. But she does say very clearly that three people come to her. St. Michael, St. Catherine, and St. Margaret. His picture depicts all three of them. And they're more than just voices. They're actual, you know, physical beings. Although they look like they're floating, right? You know, it's like there's a little fire here, a little incense jar, and they seem to be coming out of that. And they seem to be physical bodies. And it's really hard to know what Joan's own visions were because she doesn't want to talk about them to the people in the trial very much. But you can see that depictions of them are usually seen to be physical. So I want to suggest that these three voices are very symbolic and very important to Joan, and they will guide different aspects of her life as she goes on. So let me just take an excursus for a minute and explain these three saints who come to her, at least in voices. Are these things she just hears, or does she see them? This is going to come up in the trial, because they're going to, the people who are going to try to trick Joan are going to ask her, well, what does St. Michael look like? How long is his hair? And she refuses to answer those sorts of things. St. Michael is an angel in the Catholic Church. You can call Michael. Angels are also called saints. And he's the patron saint of warriors. And I'm losing the battle with this thing. I'm here. Is that on? There. Okay. Does that work? So he's the patron saint of warriors. And one of the things that we'll see is that one of the aspects of Joan's life is that she's going to be a soldier. This is going to be central to who she is as an individual because God calls her to be a soldier and to be a part of that. And so St. Michael seems to give her advice as a warrior. Secondly, he's the simple one. The other one's a little more complicated. St. Margaret of Antioch. St. Margaret of Antioch is the patron saint of shepherdesses. And of course, now all of a sudden we see this makes a lot of sense for Joan as well, right? Because Joan is a shepherd or a shepherdess. And the story of Joan of Margaret of Antioch is that her father, she grows up in Turkey, southern Turkey. Her father is what they call a pagan priest, a priest who believes in religious traditions, in this case, the Roman religions. And her mother dies very young, so the father gives her to a midwife to kind of take care of her, and the midwife happens to be Christian, gets her baptized, and then Margaret is very taken by this woman who is a shepherdess, and they work together and raise sheep and those sorts of things, but also dedicates her life to God. In the meantime, a young a lord of the area wants to marry her, but she's already dedicated her virginity to God, to being wedded to Christ. And so she refuses that, and then she's tortured. And one of the tortures is that she's cast to this dragon, but she's wearing a wooden cross, which in this picture you can see in her hand. And the dragon, because of the wooden cross, has to spit her back out. And then she is eventually beheaded as a martyr. She dies young. That's important. She dies at a young age. When did she live? The legends are about the year of the 4th century. It's interesting that early on, and already in the 5th century, Pope Gelasius I and later on Pope Paul VI in 1969 said, this is really not the story about dragons and all that story. She's not really a saint. We can't find any historical evidence of her as a physical being. So she was taken off the saints list. Interesting. But this is one of the voices Joan hears. Now, secondly, the third one is St. Catherine of Alexandria, patron saint of philosophers. Well, how does she come about? Well, in Alexandria was the great center of learning in the ancient world, in the Roman world. And she was born of noble birth, Catherine was, and her parents started training her, educating her at an early age because she was wealthy. Her father was actually the governor of the area. And she's so well educated that she's at a very young age, again, this should be a pattern now, you see between these two saints, she's going to die at the age of 18 or 19, which is the same age Joan dies as also the other saint. She will have some scholarly debates with local people. She becomes very smart, very intelligent, and she starts converting local philosophers and people who are the leading thinkers of that age and day and age to Christianity. And as a result, the emperor gets mad at her. Maxentius is the name of the emperor. And Maxentius then thinks that, well, okay, maybe because I can't stop her, I'll try to woo her to marriage. She refuses his advances, and again, she is killed. Her body is eventually taken to St. Catherine's Monastery in Egypt, which is now the great St. Catherine's Monastery remains there and has some of the oldest versions of the Bible that we have anywhere in the world. Now, scholars and other historians have looked at her life and say, you know, she looks a lot like a woman by the name of Hypatia, who is a Greek mathematician, a wise woman, who was killed by Christians in the 5th century. It's almost like it's the same story in kind of reverse. And scholars doubt that you know, that she was a real person suggests that this was probably, she was probably a legend. There is another woman like her who was Christian, but the stories written by Eusebius early on seem to be a lot like Catherine's stories, and Pope Paul VI also in 1969 also represses her stories as a legend, says that she wasn't a person. Interesting. Well, that's a really great question, because in the case of Catherine, it wasn't in both of their cases, it wasn't for hundreds of years. So that was part of the reason that these legends... Yeah, part of the way you wonder about whether the person's historical or not is you actually go to the place and see if there's anything that ties them to the legends, and if there's some sort of, and when does that start, and what sorts of written record do you have, and then you go back as far as you can and say, well, this doesn't start until the 6th century or 8th century or something like that. Then you become a little more skeptical. And that's kind of how that worked. Well, Joan of Arc is... As a young girl, I had to throw this in real quick. I don't know any of you know the great actress Maude Adams. She was the first, she became popular by making, she was the first Peter Pan on Broadway. And, you know, the young girl who did the Peter Pan show. Alphonse Mucha, the great Czech artist, used her as a model for a play that was being produced, and this actress. And this is her hearing the voices. And I like this picture a little bit because there's a sense of terror in her eyes in this picture. And so she starts hearing these voices, and the voices have a clear message to her of what she's supposed to do. But Meredith is pretty young, right? You know, and what is she supposed to actually listen to these voices? She has a lot of self-doubt. She's 13. She doesn't know whether... her voices, are these real? Is she supposed to listen to them? Is she going crazy? And what the voices are telling her is that she should do two things. That the French will win a very important war that they're in because of her. That she will die young, and that she will be present at the coronation of the King of France. There's no way in her life that she can believe that, right? So for 3 years, she struggles with what she's hearing. Towards the end of those 3 years, her father, this is a statue of her father in Domremy, they owned about 50 acres of land, farmed it. They also, he had to work other things. He was like a tax collector in the area and did some things along those lines. He hears that his daughter is having these visions, and he reprimands her. He says, you know, get these crazy thoughts out of your head. But still the voices persist. This is in the Louvre. This is a statue in the Louvre of Joan hearing the call by an artist named Dijon. What I love about this picture is notice that she's got the armor kind of leaning up against her, and notice she's already got the shoe armors on her legs under her dress. And if I could spin this around, on the back side, you would see a scissors with her haircut. Because these are two things that the voices tell her to do. Cut your hair, and you're going to need to wear armor. Now Joan is really doubting herself. This is not something you do in medieval society. So let's put the context of what's going on and why this is so strange. The Black Plague, which killed a third of Europe's population, happened in the 14th century, the middle of the 14th century. The population level of Europe would not get back to the same level until the 18th century. That's how devastating that plague was. And Europe was in this very, very dark place. If you look at art, you see before 1350, you see representations of people buried in their finest, they look really strong and everything. And then after 1350, the art starts showing skeletons and skull and crossbones and those sorts of things, and very, very realistic images of death and plague and those sorts, because that really affected Europe a lot. And after that plague, Europe went to war for 100 years. And that war was fought entirely on French soil and completely devastated France. And you can imagine the sort of chaos that was going on in the midst of all of this. And the war goes from 1337 to the 1452, and Joan dies in 1431, so she's going to be responsible for the end of the war, but not quite the full end, but most of it. And Joan, one of the things that's strong in her ideas is that she, after hearing these voices, wants to somehow bring peace to this war-torn world. And this is what she wants. She wants to seek justice, and she wants peace, and she wants just normal everyday life. She says in her trials, "All I ever wanted from my visions was that I could go home and be a shepherdess again. To live without fear of pillage and plunder, to live without fear of war or disease. That's what I want, not only for me, but for my people." It takes her a long time. She has a relative. Some of the records say it's an uncle, others say a little more distant. A relative that she goes to, this kind of almost sneaky looking guy over here on the left. He goes to him and says, "What should I do?" And he says, well, he happens to be connected to a man by a Robert of Beaurecourt. And just to give you an idea of what's going on in France, I'm going to throw this map up here. So how is France divided? What happened was the English king has a claim to the French throne because one of the French kings is not able to have a son. And so the question, actually the English king has the clearest claim to the throne in France. And so the English eventually come down and they take over that pink area. Notice that up in the top, and they also own Bordeaux. Another duchy over here, the Duchy of Burgundy, they make really good wine there. The Duke of Burgundy, he also has his own desires and claims for the French throne. He allies himself with the English, even though he's French. And then the rest of this is all the French crown. Now, this is where things get a little bit complicated. I want you to remember, now notice how Orléans, this town up here, is at the edge, and there's not much after that. And we'll see this is going to be important in a minute. So the king of France at the time was Charles VI. One of the problems with Charles VI is he's going in and out of bouts of insanity. And so his wife basically helps take over, becomes a regent, and is co-leading with him. And one of the problems happens is that the English are so close, all they really need to do is defeat Chinon, and all of France is theirs. They're at their most desperate hour at this point. For the last 50 years, all the battles have been won by the English. The French are on the ropes. They have nothing left in the tank to fight. And so the wife of Charles VI signs the Treaty of Troyes in 1420, which basically says that when Charles VI dies, the throne will go to Henry V, who's the King of England. And you might know the great Shakespeare play, Henry V. And it will not go to her son, who is Charles VII. But what a twist of fate happens in 1422, notice it's just 2 years later, Charles VI, who's insane, dies, and Henry V dies, and it leaves the throne wide open. Now, there is this great controversy at this point. You know, we're not sure. There's great upheaval. Nobody knows who's going to be king, whether it's going to be the English or the French or what's going on. And suddenly people start remembering that there are these prophecies. Prophecies that come from two people in particular, the great Venerable Bede, who is from England, oddly enough, very interesting. Venerable Bede, who lived a long time ago, writes about a vision. He says, "France will be lost by a woman, but it will be saved by a maid from the borders of Lorraine." There is also a book that is circulating about King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table, written by Geoffrey of Monmouth, and a book written about Merlin. It's a complete fabrication. Merlin didn't exist. But nevertheless, the same prophecy is in that book as well. And now Joan, with the help of her relative, by the way, Joan is from the borders of Lorraine, exact same place where these prophecies have come from. She gets to meet a man by the name of Robert of Beaurecourt because of her relatives knows this guy. And he's a garrison commander. She meets him in May of 1429, and he sends her away with harsh words. Are you kidding me? You're a 16-year-old girl, and you came to me, and you want to go meet the king? Get the out of here, right? You know, he has nothing but, and she leaves. She has to leave. Her father hears what she has done and says, I would rather kill my daughter in cold blood than allow her to go off and be in the armies. Well, what he thinks that means, her going off to the armies, is going off to be a prostitute. That's usually what women do when they go off to the armies. But she goes back, her father is angry, everybody is mad. But again, she goes back in January of the same year, and she tells him, my voices have told me something. That on this day, as we speak right now, there is a battle going on, and the French will be defeated, and they'll be defeated this way. Beaurecourt sends her away, tells her she's an idiot. Until a couple days later, he hears that the exact details of the battle that she had described had happened. And so she comes, the Battle of Rouvray, and he calls her back and says, I don't know what to make of you. I have no idea what to make of you. And there's a couple soldiers who are taken by her, and they say, listen, we'll take her to meet the Dauphin. The Dauphin is the crown prince of France, Charles VII. He can't be crowned, I'm going to just jump back here a minute, because the place that all the French kings have been crowned since the year about 815 is the town of Reims, and it's completely controlled by the English. And so they can't get him crowned. So as a result, he's just simply called the Dauphin, the heir to the throne. And so Joan, now notice she's wearing a dress here. This is going to be important. Joan starts out wearing a dress, and these soldiers are taking her to go meet the Dauphin. He's in Chinon, which is south of where Orléans is. It's a safe area. And while they're going on the way, some people suggest that Joan should put on some armor. They say to her, you know, listen, we're going to go through some dangerous lands. We're going through enemy territory to get you to meet the French king. So let's pretend you're a page. Cut your hair even shorter. Make you look like a boy. And you don't talk. If anyone talks to us, we're going to get you to meet the king. And it works. The ruse works. This is the armor used in one of the movies about Joan of Arc, which I'll talk more later. So Joan comes before the Dauphin when she is 17 years old, and he is 26, and he is waiting to take his throne. He is a very immature, poor leader. And when she's supposed to come in and meet him, Robert of Beaurecourt says, listen, this woman, I don't know how she knew about this battle. There's something about her. I think you should meet her. And the king says, well, to his advisors, what do you think we should do? And then one guy says, well, listen, this could just be a plot. What, you know, once she walks in, grabs out a knife, stabs you, you're dead. You know, all of France belongs to England. No, let's trick her. We're going to do something different. The guy says, let me pretend to be king. So he switches clothing with the king, and he sits into the throne. And then the king goes into the crowd. And they bring Joan into the room. And the king, who should be sitting back here, Joan walks into the room, and she's puzzled. She walks towards the king, but stops. And then she turns and starts looking around the room. And she sees the king and walks to him and kneels before him. And the king says, and everybody's kind of afraid at this point. They don't know. They think she's a witch, right? You know, the Something magical about this woman. How did she know? There's no way she could know who the king was. And she is told. She tells him, my voice has showed me. They showed me who you were. And I have come here to put you on your throne. And you need me, because God has sent me. Charles VII doesn't believe her. She says, give me 5 minutes alone. Just 5 minutes. That's all I ask. You and me, conversation alone. Everybody goes, no, that's not going to happen. But they search her. They make sure she's got no weapons. She's 17. She's not that tall. And, you know, even though Charles isn't much of a fighter himself, they think he can hold her off if he screams. They go into a room right next to the throne room, and she tells him something. We don't know what it was. Charles VII, his mother, who signed the Treaty of Troyes, gave up the throne for her son to the English crown king. Why? There were many rumors about Isabella that she had had affairs and that Charles was not the legitimate son of Charles VI. And so his own throne was under a cloud of mystery. Some people speculate that she knew something about that, or whatever she told Charles, it was something only Charles knew. Because when he hears it, he comes into the room and says, take her. I believe her. Now, it must have been something incredibly convincing. At the trial, she's constantly asked, what did you tell the king? That's between the king and me. My voice has said I should not tell anyone else. And we still don't know to this day what that was. But she picks him. Remarkable. Well, Joan recognizes the Dauphin, and the Dauphin then recognizes her as authentic. And this is a picture from the day when Charles lived. It's in the Louvre. He's buried in Saint-Denis Church outside of Paris. And so it kind of gives you an idea what he looks like. I mean, he's a bit of a sourpuss. He's not a real great king. He's very insecure. But he finds the security that Joan gives him that he hasn't had before this point. So Joan has had all these doubts about herself and who she is, but now because she's kind of remained true, she's incredibly persistent, keeping going back after month, working at these things, she has a remarkable talent for leadership. So they decide to send her along to Orléans. Remember, that's that city. It's the last stronghold, the last hope. It's about to fall, and if it does, all of France is England's, and our history is very different. Well, Joan goes with the troops, and the king gives her some armor, and it's a very odd sort of problem. As they start out, the king says, is there any way to kind of test whether Joan is really who she says? He still has doubts about her. They take her to the faculty at Poitiers. The faculty examine her, and when they're all done examining her, she's given a test to who she says she is. She's asked deep theological questions and answers with sort of alacrity that they're really surprised. In the end, the king says, is she who she says she is? And says, we don't know. But the only way to find out is to see if what her voices are telling her is true. And one of the things the voices have told her is to go to Orléans and to raise the siege, to win that battle. If she could win that battle, maybe we could believe her. But how does a 16-year-old girl win a battle? And on the way, while she's going with these soldiers, nobody will listen to her. One of them is a guy by the name of Lahire. And he swears and he curses and he's a rough, hard drinking, you know, one of those guys. And he won't listen to Joan. By the way, notice her armor here. Semi-feminine, semi-masculine all of a sudden. Notice this is going to be really important as we get to something later. So she eventually is allowed to be in the room and talk with him. And she gives them some advice. when they get to Orléans. And she says, what I'm going to do, she actually finds a sword. She has a sword. In a vision, one of her voices tells her it's under an altar on a church on the way to Orléans. They dig it up. They find the sword. They give it to her. Again, a big. It's rather surprising. The soldiers are starting to come around a little bit. And she says, all I want to do is be the standard bearer. I'm going to carry the standard into war. She never once raised her sword against anyone except her own soldiers. She used to beat them with the flat of the sword if they were lazy or if they didn't do penance before they went into a battle or if they didn't pray properly or something. But she never once used her sword on anybody, never killed anybody. But she would take her banner and she takes them into Orléans. And she comes and says, we should attack this wall. And all the people say, that's insane. That's the worst wall to attack. She said, but there's no defense there. My voices have told me you should attack that wall. They attack, and in nine days, they win the Battle of Orléans. And she marches into the city. And people start taking notice. That's Charles de Gaulle in World War II, using Joan of Arc as an image. The final assault in which Joan spurred the troops on, she kept carrying her banner into the most dangerous places. And in the last assault, you can see that arrow coming down. It's going to strike her in the shoulder. And she will go down. And at first, everybody thinks she's dead. And she will say, pull the arrow out, bind it, and she goes right back into battle. And the soldiers were ready to pull out. And that was the last minute attack that wins the battle. She comes into Orléans as a victorious hero. And it becomes a turning point in the war. With the Battle of Orléans, Joan has now got credibility. Soldiers are willing to listen to her. They're shocked. They're a bit surprised. And the other thing that she loves to use is she starts using a new thing called artillery, cannons, and those sorts of things, which really hadn't been used very much. And she would say, this is where you shoot at a wall in order to get the entire wall to collapse so we can attack. This is a replica of her banner, which had a picture of God the Father, two angels, and then the Virgin Mary's name on it. What happens after this happens quickly. Notice again the armor here. Right now it's even more feminine. We'll talk about that. As a warrior in 1429, after the siege of Orléans in May 8th, she quickly pushes on battle after battle after battle, moving quickly till a stunning defeat, an absolutely stunning defeat of the English at the Battle of Patay, and even gets back to the city of Troy where that sign, Troyes, where the treaty was signed, and leads the French king all the way back to Reims. The road is now open to Reims where she can have him be crowned king. And she would constantly, on the way, encourage her soldiers to piety. And one of the things that we find about Joan is that after there were great battles, Joan would go out and minister to English soldiers who were wounded because they were left by the French soldiers. And when she was standing at Orléans at the gate, she says, I want you out of France. Just leave. We don't want to fight you. We don't want any bloodshed. We don't want any war, but we will do that if that's what it takes for us to have peace. And so there was this odd sort of tension in her. But on July 17th in 1429, she is able to crown the Dauphin, Charles VII, king, and she's there with her banner in Reims Cathedral. If you ever go there, there's a famous Chagall stained glass window called the White Crucifixion there, and it's a beautiful cathedral with smiling angels on the outside, which is rather unusual. So Charles is crowned, and suddenly France has new hope. But there is also a problem. I told you Charles VII was a bit of a weak leader, and now he's feeling even weaker because he owes his throne to a young girl. And so he starts removing himself from Joan. Joan is now going to give him advice. We should do this. We should go do this battle. And there's soldiers, some of her soldiers are saying, yeah, yeah, we should do that. I mean, listen to her. I mean, we look where we're at, right? You know, a few months ago, we were about to lose the war. Now we got the king crowned in Rome. This is great. But the king signs a treaty. And it stops the wars for a while. And suddenly Joan doesn't have anything to do. Well, those weren't going to last very long. The wars start up again. And in one of the battles, she is wounded by a crossbow. You can see it's in her leg there. This is in a battle against France. And they were never able to take France, excuse me, Paris. They were never really able to take Paris with Joan. There's a spot in Paris, if you've been to Paris, by the Louvre, there's a gold statue of Joan on a horse. Have you seen that? That's the very spot where she was wounded in the battle at that time. The king does give her some honors. He gives her a coat of arms. He makes the city of Domremy exempt from taxes. And he gives her honor, and he hopes that this is going to placate her. But Joan is not happy. She still feels that her mission is not done. They need to drive the English out of France. And so she goes on a campaign with some of her generals to the city of Compiègne, which was the summer palace of the French kings in that area, still a very beautiful area in northern France. And as she's doing this battle, she's fighting with the Burgundians, who have this alliance with the English. Suddenly, they're surrounded by troops, and she is captured. They try to ransom Joan back to Charles VII. They figure they'll get a lot of money for her. Charles sees it as an opportunity to have her out of his hair so he can be a king. So he doesn't pay the ransom. So who pays the ransom? The English. The English buy Joan and take her to a city called Rouen, which is in northern France, in English-controlled territory. On the way, they put her into various prisons, and at one point she jumps from a 70-foot window from one of the castles, and she survives. And later in the trial, they would ask her, were you trying to commit suicide? You were trying to commit a mortal sin. She says, no, I'm just a soldier. I'm just trying to escape. That's what soldiers do, right? But in any case, this brings on the third act of her life, the trial. And this is where she comes into conflict with the church and where she comes in conflict with the institution. Here you can see her dressed in a kind of a page outfit. But one of the things that we know from the records and from what we hear is that Joan refused to take off her armor. And the reason she refuses to take off her armor is because putting on armor is very difficult, it's very cumbersome and takes a lot of time and you need lots of help and those sorts of things. And she was afraid of what happens to young women in prisons when they're captured by other soldiers. And part of the reason she doesn't take off her armor is because she's afraid of being raped. She's also been told by her voices not to take off her armor because this is part of her identity, this is her role all along. And her voices tell her that they will be with her through the trial. So on January 9th in 1431, Joan's trial begins, and charges are brought to her by a pro-English prelate. Everybody in this trial was completely against her, and so many rules about court and trials were broken. I'll point that out in a second, but the man who puts her under trial is Pierre de Cochon. And also, there were two English dukes who were there. The Duke and Earl of Bedford and Warwick are controlling everything. They're controlling Cochon. So it's completely a railroad trial. And so what are the trial irregularities? This is a replica of the tower. There's a tower in Rouen. You can still see it. This is where Joan would have been held prisoner during this time. Well, first of all, the first irregularity is the trial was financed by the English and overseen by English lords. It was a complete English inquisition. She was being tried by a religious court. And so then what the issue is if it's a religious court, they have to find her guilty of being a heretic, of some false teaching. But what her own problem is that she was just a soldier who was good and had defeated the English. So they have to find a way to make up some charges about her, but they couldn't find any of them. And there were no lawyers to represent Joan. She had to represent herself. She's 18, 19 years old, illiterate, and they are going to try to trick her in every way they can. Now, this is where I think that story of Catherine of Alexandria comes back. Because remember, she's the one who confounds the philosophers and the great thinkers of that day and then wins them over to her side. So Joan is put on trial. She asks to be tried by the Pope. They refuse to do that because, you know, that could open things up and they can't control it anymore. And then she might get away. She asks that she be put in a convent, which is what women prisoners should be done. They should be put in a place where she's guarded by women and not by male soldiers who might, and I think all in all likelihood did rape her in this prison, but they don't do that. One of the doodles in the margin of one of the scribes at the trial has this little doodle of Joan of Arc. And it suggests, I think, a positive, actually, image. And as the trial went on, she slowly started winning people over, oddly enough. How does an illiterate 19-year-old do that? Well, she has an astonishing gift of observation and direct honesty. She is always very, very clear about what she's doing, about her vision and her goals. And she says, one point she says, I am not afraid. I was born to do this. She knows that what she's supposed to be here for is to speak this sort of truth. And what is the truth? So they ask all sorts of questions. Questions like, Joan, did you ever go out to that tree outside in Do-Re-Mi and play the Maypole, which was a Druidic festival from Ireland that was popular amongst the Celts in northern France? Did you ever do that? She says, yeah. Well, do you know that that was a false religious tradition? She says, just a stupid game. Right? You know, I never thought of it as a religion. I'm a devout Catholic. I love God. I love Mary, Jesus. But they always tried to catch her with these little sorts of things. And the trickiest question they asked her was, Joan, are you in God's grace? And if she says yes, they can say, well, how do you know? And if she says no, then she's condemned. But her answer was, well, if I'm not in his grace, may God place me there. And if I am in God's grace, may he keep me there. She absolutely stupefied her audience. They used every theological trick and gimmick in the book to try to get her to be tricked, and she was astonishing. They kept her up for days on end and would rush her into trial and try to get her to contradict herself. And many times in the trial record, she says, you've already asked me that 10 times. And if you go back and look at it, it was actually 10 times. She would remember the number of times. You've already asked me that 10 times. I don't need to answer that again. She said at one point in the trial, one life is all we have, and we live it as we believe in living it. But to sacrifice what you are and to live without belief, that is the fate more terrible than dying. When I read the trials with my students, after I'm done, I make my students split up and we have a trial in class. I make some of them Pierre Cochon, I make some of them Joan. And I say, you work out the strategies. And when we're all done, everybody's astonished. They say, this group over here that's Pierre Cochon, they go, she is really frustrating. We cannot catch her. There's nothing we can do to get her. And this group says they felt energized by the sort of courage and strength and simple honesty, speaking truth to power. But she despairs at this time in her life. She's completely hopeless. Cochon would come in, interrogate her in her cell. They falsified the record so that they tried to make her look worse than she was. And if you read the record, she looks remarkably good, even though all these records are written by her enemies. How good must she have looked? She becomes ill. We're not sure why. Was she poisoned? Possibly. But what seems to be the case is it seems she ate some bad fish or something and seems that she's on the verge of dying. She wants confession. She wants last rites. Koshan says, I'll give them to you under one condition. You take off those that armor and you wear a dress. She says, okay. She takes it off. She gets confession. She is gets communion. She gets last rites. And then she gets better. Now there is a problem. Now, when she's ill, Koshan gets her to sign a letter. And he says that in the letter, she's just admitting that she was wrong and that she needs to, you know, trust in God or something like that. And she says, well, I'll sign that. You know, I know I made mistakes and things like that. I'll sign that letter. But then he gives her another letter she can't read, right? Which says that she's guilty of these crimes. And one of the crimes that she's guilty of, and this is her signature, would have looked something like that. This is called her abjuration. And the other thing, she says that she, wore men's clothing. One of the problems is that she's wearing men's clothing and going to communion. And they're saying, they used a text from the Old Testament that says women shouldn't wear men's clothing and men shouldn't wear women's clothing or something like that, and said this is a great crime against God, just taking one verse out of the book of Leviticus. That sounds familiar. And then they would, she says, and so she basically admits to the crime of wearing men's clothing. She goes back to her prison room. She is, you can see that her guards are rather hauntingly cruel in this picture. This is by Howard Pyle, the great children's book author, who's written about Joan as well, but he also has written lots of books on King Arthur and them. And this, he was also an artist. This is his picture of her in prison, and you can kind of feel that forlornness. There's a communion card in the Catholic Church. It depicts Joan's last communion, which she got for the kind of the last rites. But then something happens. Her voices come to her. They've been kind of gone for a while. She's going through the sickness. She's all alone. She's in this deep despair. And the voices come back and they say, it's time to put back the clothes. Put on your armor. In the 19th century, when photography started, they were really... they did things called tableaus where they would reenact historical events in the past. And in this is a tableau of Joan of Arc putting her armor back on and trusting in God, saying, I should never have taken my armor off. I wasn't myself. But notice what happens. If you're convicted of being a heretic in the Middle Ages, you would go to prison. Joan should go to a monastery with women where they would take care of her. That would be it. That would be the end of it. She would stay there the rest of her life. But that's not good enough for Koshan, and it's not good enough for everybody else that's there. They want her dead. And the only way you can put somebody to the stake is if they admit their heresy and then they relapse back into it. By putting that clothing back on, Joan knew she was going to burn at the stake. Notice what she's convicted of. Wearing men's clothing. Astonishing. Here's a picture of Joan just having put on her clothing again. And notice one of her voices comforting her at her feet as she's getting ready. Well, this meant inevitably that Joan would be burned at the stake. She was taken to the city square in Rouen. You can still go to the very place where she burned. She was tied to the stake, and she asks for a cross because she wants to keep her focus on the cross of Christ as she dies. And so one of the soldiers there takes two sticks and just winds them together and gives them to her. This is Jane Seberg in, I spelled her name wrong, it's one E. Jane Seberg in the movie Joan of Arc by Otto Preminger called the movie called Joan, Saint Joan. It's a play originally by George Bernard Shaw. It's noticed George Bernard Shaw is fascinated by Joan of Arc. Twain is fascinating. Joan has this ability to win over these great cynics of life. Anyway, in the movie, in the actual making of the movie, the fire didn't work and it blew up, and Jane Seberg, this was her first role, she was 19 when this movie was made. She was had second degree burns all over her body, sadly. When Jane, Otto Preminger said, oh, I feel, you know, he was felt very bad, the great director. He says, we'll do the scene again. She says, no, I got it. You got an honest reaction out of me the first time, and I'm burned it already. Just keep the original scene in there. So if you see that movie, that's actually, there's a, it's horrifying when you know that she's actually being burned. She was actually, Joan had to wear this hood that says heretic, apostate, relapsed heretic. And her clothes burned off of her body. One of the other priests in the crowd brings her a cross. She's holding one. Some accounts say that it was stuffed in her shirt. And then another one was held right before her face as she burns in the public square. This is a pretty accurate picture of what the Rouen Square looks like. And this gives you another idea of the priest climbing up. Back in the early 19th century, again, photographs, these tableaus, remade these images. And I don't know if you know the great movie maker, Georges Méliès. One of the very first movies ever made was this scene of Joan burning at the Ark, burning at the stake. It's the, after the Lumiere brothers. This is one of the first scenes that we have in movie history. The very spot where Joan was burned at the stake is in the market square outside the marketplace in Rouen. And it's in front of this very modern church. The church was bombed during World War II. Thankfully, they took out all the stained glass windows, and the stained glass windows were preserved. And then when they brought the stained glass windows back, they made this, what some called the fish church. You'll see why in a sec. This statue of Joan is inside the church. I think it's quite beautiful. Memories, memory candles on there, but also kind of reflecting. She's both flame and person there. There, this is why you see what's the fish church. It looks like a giant fish tail sitting up in the market square in Rouen. It's very modern. Then in 1456, after Joan was burned at the stake, the English were eventually slowly... Charles suddenly realizes he's made a huge mistake. The English now could claim that his crown was based on the fact that he listened to a heretic. And he finally found his courage. And he started fighting, he started these various battles, and he eventually was able to drive the English out of all of France. In 1456, there was a retrial by Pope Calixtus III, and he declared her innocent and a martyr for the faith. The Hundred Years' War basically continues for about 22 years after Joan's death. Henry VI crowned himself as king of France at one point, but he was only 10 at the time, and eventually the French are able to drive them out. And at the rehabilitation trial, Joan is exonerated, Pierre Cauchon is declared a heretic, and the clothing law called the biblical rule was overturned. And in fact, if you go into medieval law and read Thomas Aquinas, for example, Aquinas says women have the right to wear men's clothing, especially if they're in fear of being raped. It's very interesting, but that was a part of that. The trial is declared a political trial, it's a mistrial, and Joan is reinstated. However, Joan appears again about 10 years after she died. She goes to Doremi, and, well, it's a fake, a woman who looked exactly like her and was very good at convincing people. She even convinced Joan's brother that she was really Joan. Now, it's 10 years later. Nobody's really seen her burn at the stake. They're not sure about that. They take her bones and grind all her bones up after she's burned at the stake. They burn her about three or four times and grind her bones down and throw her ashes into the Seine River so nobody will have any relics of her. Some relics did appear in France a few years ago. They said these are of Joan of Arc. They did a DNA test, and it turned out to be an Egyptian mummy. So there'll always be that attempt. But in any case, this fake Joan convinces her brother and others, and suddenly she gets to go all the way and meets the Dauphin. She says, "I'm back." He says, "I'm so happy, Joan. Tell me, can you tell me what you told me in the courtroom? What was that secret you told me that convinced me that you were Joan?" And the woman devolves into tears, and they threw her into prison for faking all that. And Joan is a remarkable woman. She's too feminist for conservatives and too conservative, warrior-like for feminists. She's the patron saint of cross-dressing. The patron saint of transgender people in the United States. I have a picture of that in a minute. Patron saint of France. Too political for religious folks, too religious for political parties, honored by nationalists, honored by revolutionaries, patron saint of France, prisoners, soldiers, military. Her legacy is that despite her shortcomings, she used her talents to seek justice in a world of absolute chaos that's in governments, but also to deal with the problems that were within the church. This is that statue in France where she was wounded, if you've seen this one. I put this in because, you know, we have this image of Wonder Woman. I really think that Mark Twain had it right. She was officially declared a saint in 1920. Notice how long it takes her to become a saint. Many people in England, English Catholics, didn't want that. Napoleon declared Joan of Arc a national symbol in 1803. If you go online, you can find lots of memorabilia and things that you could Joan of Arc brandy to beans and various things. There's some really bad products out there like Joan of Arc marshmallows. That's very, very bad taste. That's a very bad taste. And bikinis, I mean, how bad is that, right? Mini toast, no, that's really not good. But she is pops up in popular culture almost everywhere. It's a really great TV series that was on for a while, Joan of Arcadia. She pops up in comic books. She was parts of military campaigns in World War I and World War II. Ringley Brothers had an entire Joan of Arc series. Mark Twain says, "To believe yourself brave is to be brave. It is is one and only essential thing. Consider this unique and imposing distinction. Since the writing of human history began, Joan of Arc is the only person of either sex who has ever held supreme command of a military forces of a nation at the age of 16. So he says 17, but actually was younger than that. He says, "Whatever things men call great, look for it in Joan of Arc. There you will find it. It took 6,000 years to produce one like her. Her like will not be seen again on earth for 50,000. She is easily and by far the most extraordinary person the human race has ever produced." George Bernard Shaw. I want to close with this, and then we're out of time, and I'll hang around for questions if anybody has them. But when we reflect on her century, it was the brutalest and wickedest and rottenest in history since the darkest ages. We are lost in wonder at the miracle of such a product from such a soil. The contrast between her and her century is a contrast between day and night. She was truthful when lying was the common speech of men. She was honest when honesty had become lost, a lost virtue. This sounds like a lot like today, to be honest. She was a keeper of promises when the keeping of a promise was expected of no one. She gave her great mind to great thoughts and great purposes when other great minds wasted themselves upon petty fancies and upon poor ambitions. She was modest and fine and delicate when to be loud and coarse might be said to be universal. She was full of pity when the merciless cruelty was the rule. She was steadfast when stability was unknown, and honorable in an age which had forgotten what honor was. She was a rock of convictions in a time when men believed in nothing and scoffed at all things. She was unfailingly true to an age that was false to the core. She maintained her personal integrity unimpaired in an age of fawnings and servilities. She was of dauntless courage when hope and courage had perished in the hearts of her nation. She was spotless. She was spotlessly pure in mind and body when a society in the highest places was foul in both. She was all these things in an age when crime was the common business of lords and princes, and when the highest personages in Christendom were able to astonish even the infamous era and make it stand aghast at the spectacle of their atrocious lives, black with unimaginable treacheries, butcheries, and bestialities. And so these are two images. This is an image of her as a Catholic, of a Catholic saint, and this is the transgender card that you will see as her patron saint of transgenders. I leave you with the life of Joan of Arc. Thanks for your time. I'll stay around for questions if you have. I know we're kind of run out of time, but.